Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The ailing Algerian president is set to serve a fourth term, and 20 are killed in a raid on the UN South Sudan compound. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. Algerian President Abdelaziz Bouteflika has won re-election, a result that paves the way for him to serve a fourth term despite poor health. The Interior Ministry released official preliminary results today that shows Mr. Bouteflika captured almost 82% of the vote. He faced five contenders in Thursday's polling. The 77-year-old president, who is backed by the ruling National Liberation Front Party, was widely expected to win. However, he has made few public appearances since suffering a stroke last year. On Thursday, he arrived in a wheelchair at an Algiers polling station where he cast his ballot. Officials in South Sudan say gunmen have raided a United Nations compound housing 5,000 civilians and UN peacekeepers, killing at least 20 people and wounding 60. Officials say armed youths overran the UN mission in South Sudan's compound Thursday in the capital of Jonglei State, Bor, and opened fire. U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Samantha Power, described the assault as a brazen, inhumane attack on unarmed civilians. She said the U.S. will work with its allies to determine who is responsible for what she called a horrific attack and to bring the perpetrators to justice. South Korean authorities continue investigating what caused a ferry to capsize off the country's southern coast, killing dozens and leaving nearly 300 people missing. The unfolding situation where a modern passenger ferry close to shore quickly sank with most of its passengers still on board is raising concern about the safety of such vessels and whether the crew responded properly. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from our bureau in Bangkok.
It is not only bereaved families questioning how so many could be stranded on board a ship that capsized and sank in relatively shallow water close to a coastal island. South Korea's Coast Guard is still focused on retrieving the bodies of those inside the vessel and those being found floating in the sea. But preliminary information from investigators reveals the five-story tall ferry on a voyage from Incheon to the resort island of Jeju made a sudden sharp turn some minutes before the first distress call Wednesday morning. There are reports from survivors that the captain and most of the crew abandoned ship without even telling passengers to flee for their lives. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
A powerful 7.2 magnitude earthquake has rattled central and southern Mexico. Buildings swayed, windows shattered, and people rushed into the street during today's quake, which was felt in Mexico City, about 270 kilometers from the quake's epicenter. Officials say there are no immediate reports of injuries or major damage. The U.S. Geological Survey initially measured the earthquake at a 7.5 magnitude, but later downgraded it. In Nepal, at least 12 mountaineering guides have been killed in an avalanche that swept down Mount Everest. It's the deadliest accident on the world's highest peak in recent times. Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi.
It was early Friday when the deadly avalanche hit guides who had set out early to ferry supplies and make preparations such as fixing ropes for foreign climbers. Dipendra Podal at Nepal's Tourism Ministry's Mountaineering Department says all the victims were local mountain guides. More than 50 people, including the army and police, joined the rescue effort on the high mountain slope. At least three guides were pulled out from under the snow and were taken by helicopter to Kathmandu. Mountaineers say the avalanche struck at a relatively low elevation on the world's tallest mountain in an area known as a popcorn field. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
The United States says Russia has a responsibility to call on pro-Russian militants occupying government buildings in eastern Ukraine to evacuate. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki said today that if Russia does not take steps to de-escalate the situation and implement Thursday's deal with Ukraine aimed at lowering tensions, there will be consequences. A militant leader had said earlier that his men are not bound by that deal and will only stand down after the Ukrainian government resigns. Iran's president said during an annual military parade that his country does not want war, but has the means to deter any attacks. Hassan Rouhani said today in Tehran that his country would not invade another country, but would resist any aggression. I'm Frances Alonso, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Mistrust among people is so great to the extent that those people who rent to the Ummi's compound are considered to be of the supporters of the other side. And obviously the blame will come back, and of course that suspicion will be furthered by whatever action UNMIS may take in order to protect those IDPs.
That's Professor Simon Manoja of the University of Juba Center of Peace and Development Studies. He's commenting on the UN and the outbreak of violence yesterday in South Sudan. Details coming up.
Also in the news, the Nigerian military retracts a statement it made earlier this week that indicated most of the girls abducted from a secondary school had been freed. And women's rights campaigners in Malawi intensified their drive for equal representation in the May 20th election.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny, music from the DRC, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
The Nigerian military has retracted its claim that nearly all of the more than 100 schoolgirls kidnapped this week by suspected Boko Haram militants had been released. Nearly 100 are still believed to be missing. VOA's Anne Look reports from our West Africa Bureau.
The principal of the government girls' secondary school in Chibok, Asabe Kwanbura, said that 32 of the kidnapped girls have escaped. That's up from a reported 20 girls on Thursday.
Some jumped down inside the lorry. Some escaped within the camp.
The state education commissioner confirmed the figure, saying those 32 girls were safe and accounted for Friday. A total of 129 girls are thought to have been at the school when armed men arrived early Tuesday to take them away in trucks. The girls were only there to sit for final exams, as their school was among those closed in the Northeast in March for security reasons. Defense headquarters had released a statement Wednesday saying that all but 8 of the kidnapped girls were free, something relatives of the girls and school authorities said was a lie. Most of the girls are still missing. The defense ministry spokesman issued a correction late Thursday, saying that his initial statement was based on faulty information and was, quote, not intended to deceive. But the fumble is a further blow to the military's credibility as it faces mounting criticism for its handling of the insurgency in the Northeast. Borno State Education Commissioner Musa Unoa Kubo told VOA the false report of the girls' release has only heightened their parents' impatience and apprehension.
When you come to the town and see all parents are in a mourning mood, everybody is sad in the sense that there was a glimpse of hope when it was announced that they've secured the release, and up to now they cannot see the children.
Local vigilante groups and hunters have set out on what defense headquarters says is a, quote, frantic search for the girls in the dangerous forest near the Cameroonian border, where the girls are believed to be held. The military is also looking. No one has claimed responsibility for the kidnapping, though many are pointing to the militant Islamist sect Boko Haram, which has attacked other schools in the Northeast. The group has also reportedly been abducting girls and young women to serve as spies, cooks, and servants. Boko Haram has killed thousands in northern Nigeria since 2009. The group says it wants to impose a harsh form of Islamic law, which would include banning all forms of Western education. The kidnapping was one of 3 attacks this week attributed to Boko Haram, including a bombing in the capital, Abuja. Anne Look, VOA News, Dakar.
A United Nations official in South Sudan says at least 40 people were killed in an attack on civilians sheltering at a UN base in Jonglei State. VOA's Gabe Jasto reports the government has blamed UN peacekeepers for the violence.
The UN peacekeeping force, known as UNMISS, says an armed mob forced its way into the compound in Bor Thursday and opened fire at civilians taking refuge inside. UNMISS says peacekeepers returned fire, repelling the attackers. The head of office for the UN Humanitarian Agency in South Sudan, Vincent Lalay, told told VOA the mob was apparently demonstrating against the UN at the gates of the compound before it turned violent. Lalay said demonstrators used powerful military equipment to force their way in.
Shooting started directly into an armed civilian, mainly women and children who had taken shelter in there.
At a news conference Friday, South Sudan's information minister, Michael Makwe-Lueth, claimed it was the UN who fired at the demonstrators first.
Before they could arrive, the UNMISS force shot at them, and as a result, it provoked a situation which resulted into that unfortunate incident.
Tens of thousands of South Sudanese have sought shelter at UN bases across the country since violence broke out in December following a political rift between President Salva Kiir and his former deputy Riek Machar. In the latest fighting, opposition forces this week took over the town of Bentiu, capital of oil-producing Unity State. The government says the military soon will retake control. Lalay says more than 6,000 civilians have fled to a UN base in Bentiu in recent days, bringing the total number of people taking shelter at the base up to 14,000.
The fear factor is driving people out of their homes into a very, very difficult sheltering conditions in the UN base.
The U.S. State Department Thursday issued a statement condemning the recent violence and has called on all sides involved in the conflict to adhere to a cessation of hostilities agreement signed in January. That agreement has been repeatedly violated while peace talks in the Ethiopian capital have stalled. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Nairobi.
For more on South Sudan, we called Professor Simon Manoja, who teaches at the University of Juba Center of Peace and Development Studies. He says the United Nations needs to convince the leaders of South Sudan that it is not the enemy and that it wants to help protect people. He also says outside forces need to pressure both the government and the opposition into a meaningful ceasefire agreement. In this interview, he tells reporter Magume Wakaringi that neither side is motivated to resolve their issues at peace talks scheduled to resume next week.
Mistrust among people is so great to the extent that those people who ran to the UNMISS compound are considered to be of the supporters of the other side. And obviously the blame will come back, and of course that suspicion will be furthered by whatever action UNMISS may take in order to protect those IDPs. Suspicion is now rife. You have this accusation that this conflict had been ethnic-based. The government denies that it is not ethnic-based. Even the rebels deny it is not ethnic based. But on the ground, again, there's a lot of ethnicity in it, a lot of ethnic conflict, which is inherent.
The incident of yesterday, people were killed, civilians who are seeking refuge under the UN. What about them? What is their situation? Do you think they are going to trust more the UN that they are under protection, or even the government?
You know, even before the conflict, there were a number of inter-ethnic conflicts that had been taking place. UNMISS even now is coming more and more on the spotlight as supposed to be protector, but at the same time as an aggressor on the other side for having maybe protected people who are considered enemies within the territory.
UNMISS is caught under corner. What is UNMISS supposed to do?
Now they have been also thrown into the role of not only protecting civilians and keeping peace, but also they have now to accommodate, as part of the protection, to accommodate IDPs. And that is a tricky part, because now this is moving towards a civil war. In fact, it is already a civil war. So in a civil war situation within the same country, if somebody is sheltering the supporters of the other side, they are considered enemies of that side. You know the famous thing they said, your enemy is my enemy. Or rather, if you are my enemy, your friend is my enemy. So that kind of logic, it is now creeping into this situation. And that's why I said UNMISS is in a very tight corner.
Where do you see this heading? Do you think in the negotiations there is going to be any breakthrough despite this fighting?
There's a lot of pressure, I think, on both sides, both from within the civil societies and from the civilians in the South Sudan. Nobody really wants this war. I can see IGAD doing a lot of efforts. But again, they are complicating the matter because they want to extend these negotiations into a kind of general conference for all stakeholders. They call them stakeholders. I don't know who are the stakeholders. To me, the stakeholders in this particular conflict now is the opposition and the government. What they should concentrate on is to see that the implementation of cessation of hostilities should be properly monitored, and each side should be given very strict sanctions if they violate that cessation of hostility. The Americans have started it already. Each side that violates the cessation of hostility should be sanctioned.
That was Professor Simon Minoja, who teaches at the University of Juba Center of Peace and Development Studies. He was speaking to reporter Magume Wakaringi.
In Malawi, women rights campaigners have intensified their 50-50 drive to have equal representation in the May 20th elections. Malawi ranks as one of the countries with low female representation, not only in Southern Africa, but globally. At the moment, only 22% of 193 parliamentary seats are held by women. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Gender activists hope that the May's tripartite elections will boost the number of women holding public office, both locally and nationally. Their campaign on billboards, radio, television aims to woo voters to support many of the more than 2,000 women vying to be lawmakers and local councillors. Amy Chanika is the chairperson for the permanent committee of the NGO Gender Coordinating Network.
52% of Malawian population are women. And we are talking about that women should not just be used for dancing and for reproduction, but that they also use their intellect and their knowledge, whatever God can give them. In Malawi, most of the farming is done by women. Why should we leave them out in leadership?
The organization is providing financial, material, and more support to all women candidates, regardless of political party affiliation. Chanika says aspiring MPs are given about $500 each, while aspiring councillors get about half that amount as capital for their campaign meetings. In addition, women have received training in public speaking. Activists have also formed a media task force comprising editors and journalists from various local news organizations to help them raise profiles of female candidates. Wes Nyirongo is the editor at Capital Radio, who serves as a vice chairperson for the media task force.
So far, we've done profiles for those women. We've interacted with the women candidates on their campaign and what issues they want to put forward as they do their campaign, as well as giving them space in the media houses so that they should be known to the electorate.
Nyirongo says in the past elections, male candidates dominated media coverage due to the fact that they had money and means to finance a campaign. Despite these efforts, some female candidates say they are not benefiting and describe the 50-50 drive as more theoretical than practical. Aisha Mambo is the aspiring parliamentarian for the opposition United Democratic Front in Mangochi Nkungulu constituency. She tells VOA that while she appreciates the strides the campaigning is making through radio advertisements, the assistance given is too little to help women to win.
Efforts, I expected to get more financial support from them. As I'm talking to you, what I have got from that side is only 200,000 kwacha, which is not even enough for one big rally. And I also expected to get material support from them, but what we heard is that they may give us 50 t-shirts each, which is not even enough.
an aspiring councillor in Blantyre who opted for anonymity for fear of reprisals, says the 50-50 campaign is spending too much money on media to make ads and jingles to promote women in general. She argues the money would be better spent financing individual campaigns. Amy Chanika defends the Gender Coordinating Network's effort, noting that the assistance given only aims to complement what the candidates had budgeted for and not necessarily fully bankroll their campaign. The Sunday Times social commentator George Kasawala has written in his column that he doubts this 50-50 drive will yield the desired results in the May polls. He says there are only 257 women out of a total of 1,292 candidates vying for the 193 parliamentary seats. He also notes that 44 constituencies have no women running at all. He suggests Malawi should have taken a page from Rwanda's book, which legislated affirmative action by reserving 30% of seats in parliament for women. Women now hold half of the legislative seats in the lower house in Rwanda, making the small African nation number one in the world when it comes to the number of female lawmakers. Malawi's president, Joyce Banda, who is running in the May 20 vote, is one of only three African women to hold the highest office. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. A new study finds that young children suffering from diarrheal diseases are less likely to receive life-saving oral rehydration therapy, ORT, when seeking treatment in private clinics. The research is the first large-scale study of the treatment of diarrhea for children, was recently published online by the American Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene. It found that closing the gap between public and private clinics with regard to access to ORT could save the lives of 20,000 children under 5 years of age every year. I spoke with Zachary Wagner, co-author of the study and doctoral student in public health at the University of California, Berkeley. He explained what prompted fresh research into this inexpensive but highly effective treatment for diarrheal diseases, oral rehydration therapy.
This study is really motivated by two factors, and the first is that there's hundreds of thousands of children that die from diarrhea each year, and this is particularly tragic because there's a very effective and very cheap treatment for diarrhea that prevents death. This is called oral rehydration salts or oral rehydration therapy. And basically, it prevents the dehydration that's caused from diarrhea, which is usually what kills the children. This treatment is just widely underused, and that's why so many children continue to die. It's been around since the 60s, yet it's still widely underused. And so understanding ways of increasing ORS use is really important. And so even when children seek care from healthcare providers, they still frequently fail to receive ORS. So that's kind of the first motivating factor, is understanding ways of increasing ORS use. So the second is that many of these children seek care in the private sector. The private health sector is becoming more and more prevalent in sub-Saharan Africa and throughout the developing world. So understanding what kind of care is being provided in the private sector is really important. So we set out to understand how care for diarrhea in the private sector compared to care for diarrhea in the public sector. We found that ORS, this really important treatment, was way less likely to be provided in the private sector for child diarrhea than in the public sector.
Okay, looking at oral rehydration therapies, first of all, can you explain exactly what it is and then how expensive is it for African countries to use it?
Oral rehydration salts were created in the late 1960s and widely distributed and became widely available in the 1980s. Around this time, it was lauded by the medical journal The Lancet, a very prominent medical journal, as the most important advancement, medical advancement of the 20th century. It's a huge deal, and it really has not got as much accolade as it seems like it should have. And really, it's just a basic mixture of sugar, salt, and water, and it's frequently accompanied by zinc. And it's incredibly cheap to make, and it's about 50 cents. So it's sold in little packets now. So you just mix the little packet with about half a cup of clean water. But it's also possible to make a homemade solution, which is far cheaper.
What age ranges does this show to be most effective with?
For all children under the age of 5, it's effective, and it's effective throughout the course of your life. So it's also used for non-diarrheal cases. So it's being marketed in the U.S. now to athletes. So it's just a very effective rehydrating solution. It doesn't apply just specifically to diarrhea.
Do private health care providers in sub-Saharan Africa, do they have access to this?
Health clinics should definitely have access to it. It's very widely distributed. It's known among all development organizations. It's the World Health Organization, smaller NGOs. They've made a huge push to make sure that it's available. And it's definitely not available to all people in sub-Saharan Africa because some of them don't have access to health care. But if they're seeking treatment from a health care provider, then there's no reason that it shouldn't be available at these clinics.
What are some things that parents need to do when they're dealing with the situation of their children having diarrhea? How can they be better educated in order to get help for their children?
I think it's important that they seek treatment. If a child has diarrhea, it's important that the mother or the caretaker takes them to a healthcare provider. So ORS is really important, and it's really cheap, and they could access it themselves, but it's important to understand how to use it. In our data, we have data on people that sought care for their child's diarrhea and people that didn't, and the ones that sought care were much more likely to use oral rehydration salts. So it seems like they're getting better care if they seek care. It's just the care they get is not good enough. So they should definitely seek care, and they should always give their child this ORS. So the World Health Organization recommends that all children with diarrhea, regardless of illness severity, receive this solution after every loose stool.
That was Zachary Wagner, co-author of the study and doctoral student in public health at the University of California, Berkeley.
The French press agency is reporting that Algeria's president, Abdelaziz Bouteflika, has won another term in office. It quotes the country's interior ministry as saying that the 77-year-old incumbent won over 81% of the vote. His closest rival, Ali Benflis, won just over 12%. This will be President Bouteflika's fourth term in office.
And in a recent visit to Cairo yesterday, Canada's Minister of Foreign Affairs, John Baird, expressed concern about the Muslim Brotherhood. He also discussed Egypt's economic and political situation. Last year, the military overthrew the government of President Mohamed Morsi, himself a member of the Brotherhood. The country's military-backed government has banned the group, labeling it a terrorist organization. Canada's foreign minister said his country has taken an aggressive stand against terrorist groups. Baird added that Ottawa is tremendously concerned about the Brotherhood, which it has not banned. He added that the Canadian government bases such decisions on facts and intelligence. Al Arabiya newspaper says some observers take his comments as an indication that Canada could ban the group. It notes that Great Britain is now investigating whether the Muslim Brotherhood has any ties to violent acts or extremist groups. Canada's foreign minister also said he discussed Egypt's transition to democracy and elections scheduled for May. Baird and Egyptian foreign minister Nabil Fahmy discussed how Canada can best assist Egypt at this point.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900, 2000, and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa. This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Gunmen raid a United Nations compound housing 5,000 civilians and UN peacekeepers, killing at least 20 people and wounding 60. The Nigerian military retracts a statement it made earlier this week that indicated most of the girls abducted from a secondary school had been freed, and women rights campaigners in Malawi intensify their drive to have equal representation in the May 20th elections. Coming up, we'll have music from the DRC, and in our feature segment, the potential hazards of nuclear energy in Africa. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhi, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Time now for sports with the mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sonny Young. Happy Friday, Douglas.
Happy Friday, Kim.
What's on tap today?
Well, Kim will kick off with football.
Okay,
or
great.
Or soccer for that matter.
Alrighty.
Yeah, thank you. Manchester City midfielder Yaya Toure is one of the players that have received nominations for the Professional Footballers Association's Player of the Year Award. Ivorian Toure, 30, is Manchester City's top league scorer with 18 goals from 31 appearances. Other nominees are Liverpool trio Luis Suarez, Steven Gerrard, and Daniel Sturridge. Also nominated is winger Eden Hazard of Chelsea and Southampton's playmaker Adam Lallana. Sturridge and Hazard have also been nominated for the Young Player Award, along with Liverpool's Raheem Sterling, Arsenal's Aaron Ramsey, Everton's Ross Barkley, and Southampton's Luke Shaw. Uruguay striker Suarez, 27, heads the Premier League scoring charts, netting 29 league goals for top-of-the-table Liverpool. His strike partner Sturridge, 24, has scored 20 Premier League goals, while captain Gerrard, 33, has contributed 13 goals and 11 assists for the free-scoring Reds. In Ethiopia, the Ethiopian Football Federation has confirmed it has agreed a deal for Portuguese coach Mariano Barreto to take charge of the national football team. The former Ghana coach will be unveiled on Tuesday, according to EFF President Junior Di Basha. He replaces Senewet Bichar, who was sacked in February after a poor campaign at the African Nations Championship in South Africa. Barreto's main task will be to lead the Warrior Antelopes to the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations in Morocco. Ethiopia are one of the 21 nations who have gone straight into the group stages of the Nations Cup qualifiers, which get underway in September. The 57-year-old quit Ghana in September 2004 after just 9 months in charge, citing problems in communications with the country's football association. He went on to coach Portuguese side Meritimo and several other clubs in Europe.
The Sunny Side of Sports welcomes your comments. You can send me email at sunny@voanews.com. Sunny is spelled S-O-N-N-Y. And pick up a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper. My full postal mailing address is The Sunny Side of Sports, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, room 1613, Washington, D.C., 20237.
Missing breaking news is something that you never have to worry about.
VOAAfrica.com.
It's always there on our website, VOAAfrica.com. First, fast, fair, and in-depth news is what you get.
This is the Sunny Side of Sports, so coming to you live from Washington. Mauritius host Mauritania on Sunday, looking to overturn a one-goal deficit in the second leg of the Africa Cup of Nations preliminary round qualifier. Daylanders coach Akbar Patel has three new faces in his squad for the match after they missed last week's first leg loss in Nouakchott. Kevin Brew has been released by his Bulgarian club, Levski Sofia, while locally based Fabrice Pithia and 38-year-old Jimmy Kandasme, who plays in Reunion, have all been called up. The Mauritanians have been boosted by the arrival of Zamalek forward Dominique Da Silva, who missed the first leg because he had to play for his Egyptian club. Mauritania midfielder Adam Ba, who scored the only goal of the first leg, is equally confident of victory. His teammate Ahmedou, who plays in England, says the best form of defense for his side will be to attack and try and extend their lead. The overall winner will go into next Saturday's draw for the next round of preliminary qualifiers. They will join 27 nations in the draw for the next stage, which will be played next month. Eventually, seven countries will advance to join the 21 top-seeded sides in the group phase that will decide the qualifiers for the Nations Cup finals in Morocco next year.
Visit VOA's website at www.voanews.com. You can read in-depth reports from VOA correspondents around the world. You can also download audio and video files and play them on your computer or portable MP3 player. www.voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Yes, with just about 54 days to go to the opening of the World Cup, we go to our weekly countdown for the 2014 FIFA World Cup. And for an update, let's go straight to Lagos and join Netline Africa's Segun on the dot at DMA. Hello, Segun.
Good evening, Douglas. Serious concerns remain about Brazil's readiness. There are doubts over whether stadiums will be finished in time, and it is highly unlikely that all promised infrastructure work will be completed. Organizers will also have to worry about the widespread street protests that are expected during the tournament. Demonstrators are already unhappy about corruption, poor public services, and the billions of dollars being spent to host the World Cup and the 2016 Olympics. Right now, three stadiums and several airports are not ready. Despite the delays, President Sepp Blatter of World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, said the 2014 World Cup will be the, quote, most successful of all time, unquote. Blatter made the promise to Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff, according to Rousseff's office. Rousseff said she spoke with Blatter on the phone for 10 minutes and accepted his invitation to attend FIFA's 64th Congress in Sao Paulo on June 10th, 2 days before the kickoff of the World Cup in the city. Well, whatever happens, one country that will be looking forward to a successful World Cup is Cameroon. The indomitable Lions will be looking to recapture the good old days. Cameroon became the first African team to reach the World Cup quarterfinals at the 1990 tournament in Italy. The country has qualified for all but one World Cup since, only missing out on the 2006 edition in Germany. At the last World Cup in South Africa, Cameroon had a disappointing outing, losing to the Netherlands, Japan, and Denmark. But that is now history. In South Africa, we completely veered off target, Cameroon midfielder John McCone said. But I think we have a better team now with better organization, and the players are happy and united. Last month, the indomitable Lions were routed 5-1 by Portugal in their first warm-up match for the tournament. But Cameroon will try to regroup during a training camp in Austria from May 20th to 31st. The team will play two friendlies against Macedonia and Paraguay before putting the finishing touches to its preparations against Germany on June 1st. In Brazil, Cameroon will play Mexico on June 13th, then Croatia on June 18th, and Brazil on June 23rd. Another of Africa's five representatives in Brazil is Ghana. The Black Stars are also looking forward to a brilliant outing at the World Cup, despite being in a tough group. Football fans at home will have an opportunity to see the Black Stars in action before they fly out to begin preparations for the World Cup According to the Ghana Football Association, a farewell game has been arranged for the Black Stars against home-based players in the domestic leagues on May 31st at the Accra Sports Stadium in the nation's capital. Players from the Premier League as well as Divisions 1 and 2 will be selected to form the local squad, which will take on Kwesi Appiah's side. The Black Stars will begin official preparations with a friendly match against Holland on May 25th before moving to their training camp in the United States. Ghana is grouped with three-time world champion Germany, Portugal, and the United States in the first phase of the 2014 World Cup. Apart from Cameroon and Ghana, other teams that will fly the African flag in Brazil are Algeria, Ivory Coast, and Nigeria. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Douglas, the mighty Umpuga, in Washington.
Thank you, Segun. Segun will join us again next week for another sports report. Now let's join Daybreak Africa sportsman Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa.
We begin with golf. Defending champions and hosts South Africa amassed 23 points to retain the Africa Zone 6 Golf Championship crown in Cape Town on Thursday. Runners-up Zimbabwe scored 19 points while Namibia were third with 15.5 points. Swaziland were fourth, followed by Kenya, Malawi, Mauritius, while Zambia and Uganda are jointly in seventh position as Botswana and Lesotho shared ninth spot. Turning to football, in an all-Malian encounter, Joliba play AS Real de Bamako in the capital Bamako in Orange Africa Confederations Cup action tomorrow Saturday. Egypt's El Ahli host Morocco's Diana Hassani El Jadidi. Ivory Coast's Sewe Sports and ASEC Mimosa encounter Nigeria's Bayelsa United and South Africa's Kaizer Chiefs respectively. Elsewhere, Congo Brazzaville's AC Leopards play Ghana's Medeama. Cameroon's Cotton Sport encounter Angola's Atletico Petrolios, while Tunisian clubs Etoile du Sahel Hell and Bizertin are away to Guinea's Horoya and Zambia's Nkana, respectively. Meanwhile, FIFA Under-17 World Cup champions Nigeria begin their long journey to their title defense when they play in the regional West Africa Football Union WAFU Under-17 tournament in Lome, Togo from tomorrow, Saturday. Although the tournament is not a qualifier for either the African or FIFA Under-17 tournaments, respectively, the region takes it as a serious event for grooming young talent. Nigeria is seeded in Group B and will play Niger and Mali. Group A features Benin, Ivory Coast, and Togo. In volleyball news, the 10-day Africa Women's Club Volleyball Championship starts in Carthage, Tunisia tomorrow Saturday, where Kenya Prisons are the defending champions. For Africa, this is the first qualifier for the World Women's Club Volleyball Championships in Lausanne, Switzerland later this year. In motorsports, motorcyclists from Ivory Coast will challenge their peers from Kenya, Rwanda, Tanzania and hosts Uganda at the FIM African Motocross Championships in Kampala on Sunday. Finally, the East Africa Chess Championships starts in Nairobi, Kenya tomorrow, Saturday.
That report by Daybreak Africa's Mark Homer brings us to the end of this edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Douglas Impuga. Sunny Young will be back next week. Now back to you, to Kim. Sorry.
Okay, thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, there's an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America. In our first feature tonight, South Africa declares it will add several more nuclear power plants to its current energy mix. There are 21 other African countries thinking about pursuing nuclear power. With more than 600 million Africans off the energy grid, nuclear power is being promoted as a clean and efficient answer. But as Peter Cox reports from Johannesburg, some activists worry about the cost, the environment, and potential security hazards.
Dominique Gilbert lives near the Pelindaba Nuclear Research Center. That is where, from the 1960s to the 1980s, the South African government developed atomic bombs before becoming the first country to ever voluntarily give up nuclear weapons. When she drives by the dam next to the facility, where uranium is still enriched, she sees men casting lines into the water and eating the fish they pull out.
People eating that fish haven't been stopped fishing there.
Gilbert is a founding member of the Coalition Against Nuclear Energy South Africa. She's worried that the South African government, facing a severe energy shortage, is rushing plans for more nuclear power without public awareness of the downside.
Unfortunately, there hasn't been that much information spread around the general public about the dangers of nuclear and certainly the costs of nuclear. So it's not just health, but we believe it will bankrupt this country. It's totally and utterly unaffordable.
South Africa currently has two nuclear reactors at its Coburg nuclear power station. The waste from those reactors is disposed at the Valpuls radioactive waste disposal facility. Gilbert says South Africa has done little to study the effects of nuclear energy on surrounding communities or to educate the public.
First of all, is air releases, because people can't see radiation. They can't smell it. They can't touch it. But these particles are floating around all the time, and particularly during accidents. During routine operations, there are emissions all the time. Another aspect that worries us enormously is the river, because nuclear technologies and reactors and so forth are highly dependent on water. Pelindaba, for example, uses or releases what they term low-level radioactive waste by the thousands of liters into the Crocodile River.
While such concerns about radiation exposure have been around for decades globally, some experts believe that nuclear fuel actually poses fewer health risks than something like coal, on which South Africa is heavily dependent. Kelvin Kem is a nuclear physicist and chief executive of Nuclear Africa.
Of all the energy sources that there are, nuclear has shown itself to be the safest. And it's quite amazing how much of a public misperception there is about this, that there's been absolute scare tactics developed.
But the 2011 earthquake and tsunami in Japan damaged its Fukushima nuclear plant, resulting in the meltdown of three of its six reactors. The country is still battling to contain radiation leaks, and the impact has been felt globally. Activists say there is good reason to be scared. Kem disagrees.
At Fukushima, they call it a nuclear disaster. It was not a nuclear disaster. Not one single person was killed at Fukushima by radiation. Not one single person was injured at Fukushima by radiation. Not one bit of private property was harmed by radiation at Fukushima. Nothing. There was a general disaster from the tsunami and the earthquake, but there was no nuclear problem as such.
Perhaps not yet, but here in South Africa, some residents and workers near nuclear facilities at Pelindaba and Valpuls say they have unexplained health problems they blame on radiation. Fanki Mofiwa is with the environmental group Off the Ground Foundation.
People around the area in Kuberg, they have illnesses which even the doctor cannot explain to them what kind of illnesses that they are having. Because most of them, they always been into in and out the clinics around Valpuls. People who have lived there for quite a long time, since the dam site has been proposed, their kids are no longer feel free to go barefooted. They have side effects, so it's a concern to this community.
He points to the devastating radiation impact that the 1986 Chernobyl meltdown had on residents in the then Soviet Union.
Our decision makers, they didn't consider and follow on other accidents which happens around the world. They just considered another way, a source of producing energy, but not checking, going back, the accident which happened, like in Chernobyl. There's no one who can go there and leave the environment. It's no longer good for a human being.
But perhaps the biggest concern about a nuclear-powered African continent is a lack of stability and security, leaving nuclear facilities more vulnerable to attack or, as Gilbert worries, theft of nuclear materials for weapons.
There's a lot of conflict and political tension in Africa, a lot of increasing terrorist activity in particularly North and Central Africa, crime syndicates operating.
Knox Mesombenzi, the managing director of the Nuclear Industry Association of South Africa, acknowledges it is a legitimate concern, but one that can be managed.
We basically have a choice between isolating certain communities because of their politics or bringing them on board to the international community, where international bodies can actually monitor what they are doing. One of the conditions for having a nuclear program is that the watchdog called the IAEA has got to play its part. Irrespective of the politics, if there is a watchdog that is capable of making sure that that happens.
Gilbert isn't comforted by that idea. For her and Mofiwa, the way to avoid both nuclear proliferation and possible health and environmental issues is to invest in renewable energy sources. But in a State of the Nation address, South African President Jacob Zuma said the country will be moving forward with a project to give the country 9,600 megawatts of nuclear energy. Peter Cox for VOA News, Johannesburg.
South Africa recently celebrated one of its most popular events, the annual Cape Town International Jazz Festival. Tickets were sold out a month in advance. Dubbed as Africa's grandest gathering by the organizers, more than 30,000 jazz enthusiasts gathered in the aisles of the Cape Town International Convention Center to watch 40 artists on five stages split over two nights. VOA's Yonita Kondila reports from Cape Town, South Africa.
Hey. American musicians were strongly represented. Vocalist Erykah Badu was the headline act. Other U.S. performers include Abdullah Ibrahim, Carmen Landi, Snaky Papi, Kenny Garrett Quintet, Chris Dave, and The Foreign Exchange. The worldwide lineup also included Haitus Coyote from Australia, India's Rakesh Chaurasia and friends, and Senegal's Mo Diouf. South African acts included Jonas Gwangwa, Soul Housing Project, Black Coffee, The Soil, Bokani Daya, and the Blue Notes Tribute Orchestra, to name a few. South Africa's Minister of Arts and Culture, Paul Mashatile, attended this year's festival and explained his commitment to the event.
Firstly, as South Africa, we want to grow our arts and culture in music, in craft, in visual arts, everything. So I fully support this event. Brings a lot of people to Cape Town. It showcases our own talent, because we don't only put on stage here international musicians, it's also local. And some of the local ones are really getting a big platform for the first time. So that's great, because from here they can go places. So I have committed to support it once again. Another 3 years, the Department of Arts and Culture will be a partner supporting this initiative.
Each year, the event is organized by the company called ESP Africa, which is headed by Rashid Lombard and Billy Domingo. This year, the two men said the festival was outgrowing its current venue, a problem that will be solved by the eagerly awaited expansion of the Cape Town International Convention Center. The growth of this festival is something that has impressed the Minister of Arts and Culture as well.
I think one of the brilliant things that Rashid and Billy did was to really broaden the festival, in a sense that it's a jazz festival, but you know, you can still go to some stage and see Mikasa. Or so young people come because their kind of music is also accommodated. So it's not just purely jazz, deep jazz, but it's quite a mixture. I think that was a brilliant thing to do, and it has just grown, sold out basically. Yeah, so it's excellent.
Before the start of the festival, members of the public and journalism students could register for workshops in arts journalism. They could also sign up for master classes in jazz and urban music presented by leading musicians. And there was a free jazz concert for general members of the public. The free concert took place 2 days before the main festival in the heart of the city of Cape Town and featured artists like the UK's Shaq Attack, the Netherlands' Tasha's World, and Cape Town's rising star, Sade Ross,
who performed until the rain socked away crowds. Bigger crowds attended the main jazz festival, where they partied all weekend long. For VOA Africa, Amonati Kondile in Cape Town, South Africa.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Health officials in West Africa are struggling to contain an outbreak of Ebola hemorrhagic fever, a deadly contagion that has claimed more than 100 lives. The first cases were reported last month in Guinea, and now also are being seen in neighboring Liberia and Sierra Leone. While working to respond to the crisis, the World Health Organization has not recommended any trade or travel restrictions in the region. Nevertheless, as a sign of its concern, Senegal has closed the land border it shares with Guinea as a preventive measure. Given the deadly nature of the disease, such concern is justified. Ebola is highly infectious and has no cure. A particularly virulent virus, Ebola is believed to originate in an infected animal and is spread to humans by diet or contact with bodily fluids. Its early symptoms include fever and weakness, then deepens with bouts of diarrhea, vomiting, and internal bleeding. There have been previous outbreaks of the disease in the forests of Central Africa, but this is the first incidence of it reported in the West African nations now contending with it. They are not acting alone, though. The United States and other partners are working with international health officials to aid the fight. A five-member team from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Viral Special Pathogens Branch flew to Guinea on March 31st to provide expert advice and consultation. In addition, a small team of CDC experts will travel to Liberia to provide technical assistance to the Ministry of Health and Social Welfare. The U.S. Agency for International Development is funding a mobile laboratory in Guinea that can quickly do tests in suspected cases of the disease. Under another USAID grant, protective equipment is being provided to healthcare workers treating the sick. The U.S. Defense Department is working with Metavioba, Inc., a company that monitors viral disease threats around the world, to provide assistance for lab testing of samples from suspect cases. Our diplomatic missions in the capitals of the affected nations, as well as others, are monitoring the situation there closely. And USAID has provided $583,500 through UNICEF's Regional Rapid Response Fund to provide households and clinics in Guinea with supplies and equipment, as well as fund a public information campaign to help people protect themselves from infection. Finally, we extend our sympathies to the families and loved ones of those who have died. And for those fighting the disease, know that our hearts and prayers are with you.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.